Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, to introduce the topic of anxiety, I think I'm going to read two short, relatively short vignettes so that people can get an idea of what we mean by anxiety disorders. The first one comes from a patient who describes their panic disorder. They say, it started 10 years ago when I just graduated from college and started a new job. I was sitting in a business seminar in a hotel and the thing just came out of the blue. I felt like I was dying. For me, a panic attack is almost a violent experience. I feel disconnected from reality. I feel like I'm losing control in a very extreme way. My heart pounds really hard. I feel like I can't get my breath. There's an overwhelming feeling that things are crashing in on me. In between attacks, there's this dread and anxiety that it's going to happen again. I'm afraid to go back to places where I've had an attack. And unless I get help, there soon won't be any place where I can go and feel safe from panic. And the second one is one with a patient with what's called generalized anxiety disorder. And they comment in this way about their problem. I always thought I was just a worrier. I felt keyed up and unable to relax. At times it would come and go, and at times it would be constant. It could go on for days. I'd worry about what I was going to fix for dinner or what would be a great present for somebody. I just couldn't let something go. I'd have terrible sleeping problems. There were times I'd wake up wired in the middle of the night. I had trouble concentrating, even reading the newspaper or a novel. Sometimes I'd feel like I was getting lightheaded. My heart would race or pound, and that would make me worry more. I always imagined things were worse than they really were. When I got a stomachache, I thought it was an ulcer. When my problems were at their worst, I'd miss work. Then I'd feel terrible about that. Then I worried that I'd lose my job. My life was miserable until I got treatment. About a quarter of us at some times in our life are going to experience anxiety disorders. These are known as generalized anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, various phobias, panic disorder, and post-traumatic stress. We're going to talk with our guest today, Anne-Marie Zack. Anne is a psychiatric nurse practitioner for 20 years. She specializes in anxiety and depression and adult ADHD, and she has a private practice here in Anchorage. And Prentice Pemberton, who has been a co-host with me recently and recently filled in also when I wasn't here. He's a licensed clinical social worker at Bridges Counseling Connection here in Anchorage. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So let's flesh out these anxiety disorders a little bit more. How can we add to listeners' understanding of each of these? How do y'all want to start?
Well, I think with anxiety disorders, you really got to, you mentioned them coming in, you got the generalized phobias, OCDs, panic disorders, and PTSD. And a lot of them kind of overlap and commingle, and it's really confusing to figure out which one is the label. And people get bogged down on labels, and I know that's something that I tend to try not to get too stuck on, but it is a constant source of worry and sort of fear and anticipated suffering is what I refer to anxiety in whatever form it's in, just this sort of dread of, you know, the tiger's always chasing you.
And from my point of view as a medical person, I usually see the hyperarousal of the nervous system. You're seeing physiological symptoms, excessive sweating, rapid heartbeat, shortness of breath, all whole host of physiological issues that come along. And you keep that body under that constant state of stress with those symptoms for long enough, certainly other disorders can start occurring, like depression.
So that's where the idea that headache or stomach aches may have their origins in stress with a big quote around it.
Absolutely. I could tell you a very quick case study. I saw a gentleman, a couple years back, and he walked into my office with literally 4 inches of medical testing. He was experiencing decreased peripheral vision. He was experiencing cardiac issues, pulmonary issues, tingling in his extremities. And of course, he was sent to specialist after specialist after specialist. He came in my office in tears, put these tests in front of me, which were all, of course, normal. And when I told him I really thought he had an anxiety disorder that was not treated, he burst into tears. And 2 weeks later, with appropriate treatment, his physical manifestations of anxiety were gone.
You know, I'm also a physician, so I appreciate that. My problem is getting people to realize that it's an anxiety disorder and not a physical disorder. So you're saying eventually they come to that realization, many patients, or why did this man eventually decide to come in and address this from a psychological standpoint?
Luckily, his primary care was very in tune that this could be a possibility and suggested. And this man, again, because of the level of suffering, he was desperate. He was willing to try anything. Mm-hmm. I truly believe no one wakes up in the morning and says, I want to go see a shrink today, but out of desperation.
Yeah. I mean, we're getting off the topic a little bit, but there's this stigma still, I think, that it can't be psychological or that I don't want it to be psychological.
The stigma thing is, it's a shame that anxiety and depression and alcoholism can't be thought of in the same sort of breath as diabetes or, you know, heart disease or high cholesterol. I mean, it really is about management of that. Nobody chooses to be depressed. Nobody chooses to have an anxiety disorder. I would not ever want to walk into cars and, like, have to turn and flee. You know, I mean, it's not something that – it's not a conscious thought process. I'm going to have that happen. So I think unless you've had really dealt with an anxiety disorder, it's hard to – I mean, people just say, well, why can't you just walk through? It's just fear.
Right.
But it sort of takes on a life of its own. But, yeah, the stigma is too bad because it really is something that if it's left untreated, it gets worse and worse and worse. And there is no, there's no, like, just remission of anxiety disorders.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, and that hopefully we're going to have time and not forget to come back to the idea that you want to address these things probably as earlier better than later, which probably is true about just about any disorder I can think of, but specifically with things evolved related to how our memory and our neural circuits and so forth are working. All right, so I defined a little bit by a vignette a generalized anxiety disorder. Specific phobias like fear of flying is probably pretty clear to people. Let's open up or just describe a little bit better obsessive compulsive disorder, however. What does that mean? How does it relate to the anxiety disorder?
Obsessive compulsive disorder is a subtype of anxiety disorders where a person experiences internally intrusive thoughts and images. The most common obsessions, which again happen within the mind, are the fear of contamination, aggression, hyper-religiosity, safety and harm issues, need for exactness or symmetry, and also somatic fears. Mm-hmm. Common compulsions, which again are behavioral manifestations of anxiety, checking behaviors, cleaning and washing, counting, repeating, hoarding, ordering and rearranging constantly. And there does seem to be some strong biological basis as well as environmental basis for obsessive compulsive disorder.
Yeah, one of my very good friends, his wife used to say he's the only person she knows who has right and left socks. Didn't bother him. It didn't affect him very much, but he had to have his socks in a very specific way, is what she was telling us. But these are things that people may not understand why they're happening. They're not necessarily doing them because of a fear of consequences, or am I wrong?
No, this seems to be much more related to the biology of the brain. And this is where we see it so clearly with OCD. In terms of medication management with obsessive compulsive disorder, the first line of treatment are the SSRIs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. But we do know that over 40% of people with OCD do not respond to these medications. We also know there's a strong dopamine component with this. And how we know that is in Tourette's patients. Depending on what study you look at, 45 to 90% of Tourette's patients have symptoms of OCD. And Tourette's is thought of as tics of the body, whereas OCD is thought of as tics in the mind.
And tics with Tourette's have to, by definition, last a year. And we see tics very commonly in kids. They do certain things and get reinforced. So I'm constantly saying you want to pay attention but not draw attention when I see somebody with tics very early. Again, getting back to the idea of not too early. Now, that may be different. A simple tic may not necessarily evolve into Tourette's, but that's a whole maybe different issue. But there has to be – Tourette's is a particular genetic disorder that is associated with multiple tics and some other neurologic problems, including ADHD and obsessive compulsive disorder.
But I also thought you brought up a good point earlier. The lady with which she was having a little bit of heartburn with the way her husband organized his socks. But truly, is that life interfering?
Right.
I would not diagnose this man with an OCD, mm-hmm. with a disorder. Mm-hmm. That's his personality style, and it may work very well for him. And let's also look at the point of how anxiety is actually helpful to us. We need some anxiety to succeed at the workplace or to take tests well. I mean, it serves us well in normal everyday life. As Prentice pointed out to me earlier, if he's going fishing and he sees a bear behind him, he certainly wants to have some anxiety going. But I think the key for all anxiety disorders is how life interfering is this.
And before we come back to that, I want to flesh out post-traumatic stress as well. Mm-hmm. It's another issue. The phobias, I'm kind of leaving out. People probably understand that, maybe not. But what do you mean by post-traumatic stress, and how is that related to anxiety?
Post-traumatic stress disorder is related to anxiety disorder in that the symptomology is very, very similar. There's lots of mood shifts. There's lots of cognitive sort of distortions, this sense of fear and the sense of impending doom that something bad is going to happen, and it's always in relation to some event that was life-threatening or involved bodily harm or the loss of a loved one. Those memories seem to be burned into the brain as if they are still happening, mm-hmm. and that's the trauma response that keeps playing over and over again.
So that seems to be, and you correct me now, if that's a little different in that the sense that with post-traumatic stress, there's a very specific incident that you maybe can address. This is how it got started. Is that generally true of other anxiety? Certainly, I don't think of it as obsessive compulsive disorder, as that's part of it. And generalized anxiety, I don't think of it. Is that a distinction?
Most of them, it's really hard to sort of pinpoint.
Right.
You know, this kid I work with who has OCD who repeats these behaviors over and over and over and over again, and it's very disruptive in his life, and it doesn't make any sense to him at all.
Right.
But when we tried to go back and find out when that happened, he said, well, it's just kind of always been.
Yeah.
And interestingly, there was also two or three other family members who had OCD and that manifested in early childhood into middle, you know, 20s.
So evidence like that suggests that there's strongly a genetic predisposition. I like to think everybody can go through and start having some anxiety disorders, but some of us may be predisposed to having certain kinds of disorders and maybe predisposed to having it easier than others. Is that your experience or not really?
I think it's a mixture of genetics and environment. I think any type of earlyhood trauma, lack of nurturing, lack of stability in childhood is going to predispose a child in many ways.
Give you some anxiety.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you don't know if dinner's going to be there or what, if your bedtime's going to be at 8 o'clock or 1 a.m.
Or if dad's coming home or if mom's coming home.
Exactly.
Well, Dr. Woodard, you like to talk about temperament a lot, right?
I do.
Yes. And the temperament of children is really, really important because they have, in some studies, they've followed like shy, sort of timid kids that kind of come out of the womb that way. And they have a significantly higher incidence of anxiety disorders later in life. And and also being bullied in high school and elementary school. And so there is like this, maybe you have that predisposition and then your personality is such that you become targeted, which heightens it. So it's this, it is this interweave of environment and social and genetics is also strong.
And I also want to address the belief system. I see a lot of clients who come into my office who truly believe that if I worry long enough and hard enough, I'm going to somehow affect the outcome of an event. That's called magical thinking, and we have to confront that. I mean, that is a part of a person's belief system that they can actually impact the outcome by worrying enough.
Now you've opened it up. Now you've got it, because I think it's almost more than a belief system. It's almost a social moray in the United States that we can will ourselves to do this or that, and that is not very evidence-based.
Correct.
Is that true?
That is true.
And I think it's woven into our consciousness in this country. And with an open mind, you have to ask yourself, is that true? And You've got to be careful about anecdotes of people. But we hear that all the time.
I think we have to look at the cultural influences, you know, make more money, succeed, get higher degrees. You know, there's a lot of pressure.
You're in control. You can overcome it. You can do it.
Absolutely. And you contrast that.
You can
that
do
with
anything you set your mind to. Is that true?
Not necessarily.
I was going to say, I mean, that's a common one we hear. Man,
I don't think I can climb the mountains I used to in my 20s.
Yep. Yeah.
But you contrast that with other cultures, say a more Buddhist culture, where they're embracing living in the present.
Uh-huh.
They're even embracing the meaning of suffering. Uh-huh. I mean, that's a totally different shift than what we're experiencing in the U.S. today.
Yeah,
and that's where the stigma comes in, is that if you aren't strong enough to overcome this, the opposite is weak.
Right.
And so you must be weak. You're flawed. And and people don't like to, you know, like I went to the doctor and got my prostate checked. Everybody jokes about that. But nobody says, well, I went and saw my shrink and we talked about my anxiety disorder. And, you know, it was kind of a downer. That's the stigma. And it's too bad.
Well, we're having a lot of fun here, but I got to remember there's people listening. So I got to give them a phone number.
Yes. Give it out.
You're listening to Line One, your health connection here at KSKA Anchorage. And we're talking about a group of disorders that are called anxiety disorders. They affect about a quarter of us at various times in our lives, or about a quarter of us at some point in our lives will have some of these disorders. There are very few families probably that can say there's never been much of an anxiety issue, including me and my family. So if you've got questions or comments about what you're hearing today, here's how you get a hold of us. In Anchorage, our number is 550-8433, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number if you need that, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to be here for about another 45 minutes. After that, you can always come back to alaskapublic.org and find the Line 1 link and listen to the program again or listen to other programs, but you won't have a chance to ask questions. So you need to do it at this point if you would like to get some of that information. So anxiety is something we all have. It's normal. It's evolved in us as almost, in a sense, to help us protect ourselves from harm. But it becomes a problem when it begins to control our life, or something like that is what I heard, Prentice, I think you say. Is that true? So if you need right and left socks, it doesn't affect anything else. It's no big deal. It's not an issue, or at least it's not something that needs to be addressed.
People call those quirks. You know, they don't call them anxiety disorders, as obsessive compulsive disorders. So.
Okay, gotcha. All right. So how do you make the diagnosis? I mean, it seems like it's pretty clear you got to talk to them. Are there other standardized, valid tests and things we do, or is it just talking to people and listening to them and then trying to define how much it's affecting their life?
Well, I think, number one, a thorough evaluation. And the things that we want to look at are sleep patterns, appetite patterns, energy, motivation, how much time is spent worrying, what's their diet like, how much caffeine is the person using. Caffeine is not the good friend of a person with anxiety disorder. It will worsen anxiety. So we want to look at all of these issues in terms of getting a history. We want to know about family background, blood relatives. There's a genetic predisposition. So we want to know, did grandma have anxiety? Did mom, was she a hoarder? So these are the kinds of questions we go through to gather the information. We also want to focus on symptoms. What kind of physiological responses are you experiencing? Are you excessively sweating? Are you having rapid heartbeat? How is your blood pressure? We also want to look at the environment. I've had more people come into my office and say, I just want to be happy. And I ask them, what does that mean? And what does your life look like? Well, they're being verbally abused by their husband. You know, their children are not succeeding in school. They've overspent. They're in debt. They're worried about losing their jobs. So looking at the whole picture, a very holistic approach to diagnosis, I think, is first and foremost.
Good point.
And I think, that is important. But the interesting thing is that anxiety seems to come in such a continuum of severity from people who, like you said, it's very normal. It's everyday worry. It motivates motivates us to get our paperwork done, at least some of us. it motivates you to run away, to be safe, to fight. But also there's people with anxiety that is seriously debilitating to the point where they can't function. And that's what we're talking about. So it can be a disorder and still not be so life debilitating. It could be just bothersome, you know, and sort of an annoyance that you're worried about this or you're snappy with your kids or, you know, whatever it is. But it still could be. And those are the people that generally don't come in, you know, for services. The ones we get are the absolute, like, the wheels are coming off. And they need to get something done. And so that's quite a challenge.
And typically it's been going on a long time.
Obviously. Long time.
Long time.
Yeah. You had mentioned this prevalence, how many people I've commented that about a quarter of us. What do we know of statistically about how common it is? Am I right in saying that it's so common that most families have had some experience with it?
Go ahead.
The National Institute of Mental Health published some research, and a lifetime incidence of any anxiety disorder is 28.8%. Uh-huh. The top rated incidence of anxiety disorders are specific phobias at 12.5 lifetime incidence, PTSD 6.8%, and generalized anxiety disorder at 5.7% lifetime incidence in the United States adults.
Mm-hmm. And another stat that was interesting was that 18% of U.S. adults will experience an anxiety disorder in a 12-month period. So mm-hmm. that's just about one in five.
Right.
Right. There's four of us in this room.
And we're not talking about worrying about stuff. We're talking about it's affecting our lives, our functioning, day-to-day sleep, work.
Relationships. Absolutely. Yeah. Friendships. Mm-hmm.
The first time I hosted this show, I did not sleep. The night before, she had the same experience, but I was literally up. I think I napped for like 20 minutes and then it just played over and over and over in my head.
Right.
And imagine that every single day.
So that's normal anxiety.
That felt a little abnormal,
but if it was a disorder. Continued, I guess. I mean, again, it can be kind of somewhat hard. And then we get this issue, I guess I'm kind of jumping, and then we get some comorbidities. I mean, this, as we've already implied, this may lead to depression. And when I was thinking about this, I said chronic pain leads to depression. Chronic anxiety leads to depression. So chronic pain, and anxiety is a sense of pain, I'm saying, as you think of it in that way, then you can understand why that is a risk factor for depression. You feel overwhelmed. You can't control things. It makes you sick.
And pain in and of itself is a stressor to the body.
Sure.
And pain in and of itself will alter the brain chemicals and lead to depression and anxiety. Absolutely.
So am I too simplifying? But that's just suddenly jumped into my mind while we were talking about it.
A number that jumped out at me in reading up on this stuff is that 85%, and I saw it on several different sites, 85% of people with depression also experience anxiety and vice versa. Yeah. So they are hand in hand. It's a, you know, it's a glove fit sort of thing.
However, it's also then true, is the longer anxiety go, the more intense anxiety is, the more likely you are to go ahead and develop significant depression.
Well, if you think about it, you're depressed all the time. You're not getting your stuff done. You're behind in work. Your family's suffering. You're worrying about that stuff. So that's going to create anxiety, mm-hmm. and that's going to continue to build, and which mm-hmm. creates more depression. I mean, it's sort of mm-hmm. this, it just snowballs and gets bigger and bigger, and then it's mm-hmm. out of hand.
You can't. I mean, one of the characteristics of people who are depressed, they feel overwhelmed, and they're, because of that, they're sad and can't sleep. They don't feel like eating, or they overeat.
And there's so many symptoms that exist in both depression and anxiety, like the decrease in concentration. That's one of the big ones that I see. Just not being able to encode information correctly, whether it's from depression or anxiety.
And the irritability that goes along with it, and the effect that has on relationships, and the relationships deteriorate, and then. Mm-hmm. If you don't get in and put some of that stuff in perspective in your mind with somebody who's trained and who can do an assessment and figure out what's the root, like mm-hmm. where is this, mm-hmm. where is the source, mm-hmm. Then they can start to address some of the underlying things.
Let me remind listeners again, this is Line 1, your health connection. My guest today, I am Marie Zak, a nurse practitioner who practices basically psychiatric issues, anxiety, depression, and adult ADHD. and Pemberton, a licensed clinical social worker working at Bridges Counseling Connection here in Anchorage. If you've got questions or comments about anxiety issues, you need to give us a call or send us an email. Here's an email that I got earlier. It says, interested in knowing about the symptoms of insomnia and anxiety. And this person goes ahead and, as it relates to college students, possible causes and treatments. I mean, certainly we can address the college students, but I think this is, I think it's universal with anxiety issues, is sleep issues. I mean, they go together.
Absolutely.
They don't have to be a college student.
Absolutely.
But some of the issues in college may be specific to the college student, but treatment, pretty much the same, probably.
And the way that these symptoms play out are very typical. In anxiety, we tend to see a lot of initial insomnia where there's a lot of brain racing and the mind's wandering, and it feels like a videotape that's going over and over again. And we also see a lot of intermittent insomnia, waking up in the middle of the night with a startle reflex, worrying, not being able to go back to sleep. And I contrast that to depression, because the sleep disturbance in depression that we typically see is early morning awakening. So that gives you a little bit of a clue of how we start to tease some of these issues out.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem with anxiety and sleep is that a lack of sleep can exacerbate anxiety, which makes you not sleep. So it's like the guy who says he drinks because he feels bad about drinking. Mm-hmm. And it's the loop thing again, yeah, and the interplay of those two things. So yes, sleep hygiene is super important, getting good rest. But it is the mind will not turn off. Mm-hmm. It's this loop of information that goes.
I listen to a lot of medical podcasts, surfing for ideas for the program and also educating myself. And I was driving home one time and there was a guy from Holland or something had written a book about anxiety and particularly insomnia and sleep problems. And his suggestion was you take 10 minutes before you go to sleep every night and write down what it is that's bugging you. Just the pure idea of releasing that idea. And I've given that to a number of people. I can't say anybody's ever followed through. That's a big problem in medicine, is compliance. I mean, it seems like one of those silly ways to do things, but I've read other times since then that that is a very helpful way for people to address test anxiety or sleep problems related to worry and so forth. You guys comment on that?
There's lots of behavioral sort of interventions. Getting into patterns where you start to wind yourself down earlier in the night, you turn off all the TVs and the media at 8 o'clock, and then you do your kid bedtime stories or whatever, and then you ease into a hot bath or have a cup of tea and sit quietly and then read, those sort of behavioral. So getting a routine, writing down, that sort of, it gets it out of your brain onto paper and you sort of put it away. Mm-hmm. And then I'll pick that up in the morning when I wake up. Right. Those are sort of cognitive behavioral sort of interventions that you got lots of those little tricks that you can pull out. But just like medicine in counseling, it's follow through. Mm-hmm. It is the doing of the daily thing, because mm-hmm. if I give you a basket of tools and you put them somewhere and then you don't use any of them, right, and you wonder why you can't get that screw into the wall. Yeah. And I said, well, what about the screwdriver I gave you last week? Try that. I forgot about that. Yeah.
But I think that's one of the beauties of being in our field and having therapeutic interactions, is that you're holding people accountable. You know, you're telling me you want to get better and here's some specific steps, and you give them homework. And then you come on back with the homework assignments. And so you get to see their level of motivation. In my experience, people with anxiety are pretty highly motivated to decrease these symptoms.
We have to take a break. We have at least two callers now. I want them to hang on. I've got another email, so we're beginning to get some action here on this. But we do have to take our short break. I want to remind listeners, this again is Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue with our anxiety and our guests, Anne-Marie Zach and Prentice Pemberton. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, your health connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Line 1 Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection, originating from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and our topic today is a common one. If you've been listening, you recognize that. It can be debilitating at times, and it's anxiety disorders. About a quarter of us at any one time, we figured out it was 28% at any time we're going to suffer it. And I think it was 18% of the population that, if it was at any one year, are going to have some of these anxiety disorders. So we're discussing anxiety, and we're trying to get to some solutions, and we want to talk about that as well. My guests are Anne-Marie Zack, a nurse practitioner focusing on anxiety, depression, and adult ADHD, and licensed clinical social worker Prentice Pemberton. You can reach us at line1 at alaskapublic.org. That's our email address. Our local telephone number is 550-8433. And our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And just remember, if you're listening between 7 and 8 on Monday evening, that's a taped rebroadcast. You got to call in. Also, go to line 1 at alaskapublic.org and just look at our links. We have some videos. We have information that is reliable. That's one of the things we really try to do as best as anything we do here is give you reliable information about healthcare issues. And there are some good links to follow up more about this. This issue. Doug, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, I want to comment, first of all, just for anybody listening out there, you know, it can be overcome, this disorder, and, you know, it can lead to the black and white thinking that, you know, you're never going to overcome it, so why try? And I just want to caution people against that kind of thinking because, it's just so destructive. And
yeah.
Then I want to ask about panic disorder. It seems to me it's sort of a different class of disorder, and I wanted to get a comment on that.
Yeah, good.
And then also, just whether there are any changes anticipated in the DSM-5 about anxiety disorder.
Okay.
So I'll take my answers off the air.
All right. Yeah, thanks for your call. So we haven't talked about panic disorder specifically. Let's address that, and then we'll ask the DSM-5 question.
Typically, a panic disorder is defined as a discrete episode of unexpected terror with accompanying physical symptoms. There's a lot of fear, catastrophic thinking, fear of loss of control, death, or insanity, and that these occurrences are going to happen imminently. The physical symptoms, your cardiac symptoms, your pulmonary symptoms, neuro, gastrointestinal, and they do seem to be linked genetically. There's a 15 to 20% increase of panic disorders in blood relatives and a 40% increase in identical twins, which I find very interesting. So there does seem to be a strong genetic basis. Women tend to have panic disorders twice as often as men. A typical panic attack lasts anywhere from 5 to 30 minutes. Rarely do they last over an hour, but I've had many patients where it has lasted longer than that.
Any other comments?
I had this, I had a client once, one of my instructions to him was to sit with his panic attack and kind of invite it in and then write about it while he was experiencing it, as a way of sort of understanding it maybe a little bit better. And as he was writing, he was just talking about like a wave, a wall of just terror and fear. And he knew in his mind in that moment that it was going to be gone in about 10 minutes. But it still, it didn't help him. It softened. It didn't help him get over it any quicker. But that's one of the things that we've been working on. But panic attacks are really interesting and they're really debilitating because they can happen anywhere, anytime, out of the blue. And a lot of it's mostly seen starting in teenage, adolescent years, and then developing from there. But long term and very debilitating.
One point
and they bring on their own anxiety is one of the vignette I read at the beginning.
Soon becomes a fear of the fear.
Yeah.
And
that anticipatory anxiety can then lead to what's called a panic disorder, mm-hmm. where a person has had a number of panic attacks over their life. They now experience a lot of anticipatory anxiety that another one's going to occur. And of course, that just worsens the situation. I did want to make a comment to the caller. I think you brought up an excellent point that these are exceedingly treatable conditions. Different treatments for each one, again, but usually the best treatment is a combination of medications and therapy. And in our sessions with folks, the most important thing when we're doing an assessment for these types of disorders is for us to be able to install hope, to let people know that, yes, you don't have to suffer this forever, that there are effective treatments out there.
What about the DSM-5? He's basically saying there's a new diagnostic and statistical manual. It's just being released, I think. Is there changes in that, I think was his question. Are you aware of any?
We're aware that it will be released in May of 2013. Uh-huh. The exact changes we're not clear on as of yet. I'm not sure if you're aware.
I've read different things. Mm-hmm. Like PTSD, I read once, was going to move to more of a spectrum thing, and some of the criteria were going to change because they found that the long-term exposure to smaller traumas and neglect and sort of that kids who are neglected and isolated and not really a life-threatening, you know, killer thing, but it's still going to be qualified as a PTSD. So there's a lot of changes going to happen, depression and anxiety, and I'm not really very familiar with any of them.
Okay. They're going to be linking the mood disorders more, the depression and the anxiety, the bipolar disorders, even the affectual instability with a borderline personality disorder may be falling into that spectrum in the DSM-5.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Here's a question, pretty sophisticated one it appears to me. Can you speak to the connection between the histories of trauma and OCD behaviors? You briefly mentioned that PTSD, when speaking about anxiety disorders and anxiety disorder subtypes, I have found that many OCD behaviors are rooted in traumatic experiences, and many times the history of trauma is ignored due to the focus on the behavior manifestations consistent with OCD diagnosis. Can you further explain OCD in quotes, anxiety type versus personality?
Well, let me touch on the personality versus the disorder first. The old diagnosis of obsessive-compulsive personality disorder, the way it was defined was the person would have certain rituals, they would have structure, they would engage in certain behaviors, but it calmed them in a certain way, and it was not life-interfering. Now, these are the people who are extremely successful. These are the people who may be folding their shirts in just a certain way, but it's not really life interfering. It's a personality style. Now, it's the spouses, it's the people in the workplace that complain about the issues. So it's very egocentric. It's part of the person's behavioral style. Whereas OCD as a disorder is egodystonic. It is absolutely debilitating to a person's functioning. So there is very clear differences. With OCPD, you feel good when you're engaging in the rituals. With OCD, it does not quell the anxiety. And the relation to trauma, if you think of trauma as continued stress on the nervous system and hyperarousal of the nervous system, OCD is a manifestation of anxiety that if I can organize my external world in a perfect way, that'll quell the internal anxiety. But as we know, that does not work.
Or maybe you did something, a behavior during an event when you were being traumatized, and it somehow helped you get out of that. And so that repetitive behavior, that OCD sort of behavior, and one kid described to me, you know, like just counting the ceiling tiles when his perpetrator would come into the room, he would count the ceiling tiles, and he'd always get, you know, try to get to a certain number and then repeat it. And that sort of took him out of his head. And so then his trauma manifests itself in that OCD sort of counting behavior, and it went into other areas as well. So it was really kind of interesting.
Okay. Claudia, you're on line one. Hello, Claudia, you there? Let's take another one. Jennifer, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yeah, I have a question. I've recently been researching some different ways to deal with anxiety, depression, and mood disorders. And found this couple of plants. One is the name of ayahuasca, and the other one is iboga. And I was wondering if your doctors had any familiarization with those and the possible, you know, effects of those working.
Okay.
I've read that there are certain herbal remedies and things that go along with it that will benefit anxiety disorders. But I would say, you know, over the best advice is to eat really, really well, lots of natural foods, lots of whole foods, to take vitamins, to get good sleep, to get good exercise patterns, and do all the things that you would do to maintain optimal physical health and emotional health. So, I mean, and
well,
certainly, go ahead.
That's what I did. I tried that. See, the way the process works is you kind of go on like a really intense detox diet for a couple of weeks, and then you do an actual ceremony, and I had to go to Peru to do it. And you participate in like a 10-day ceremony with shamans and such. And do you have any idea what I'm talking about?
I do. I went to Peru and did some ceremony stuff when I was down there. But and I have
a
lot of.
What do you think of that?
You know, it's very individualized, and you have to, you know, a lot of it has to do with your belief in yourself and whatever you're practicing. But those things don't have a lot of research efficacy with them, so we really can't speak to them, you know, online as far as that goes. But it's very personal if you find something that works.
And also, I just wanted to address the herbal treatments. I'm not familiar with the two that you mentioned, but I know some of the more common ones that people have tried with some success, akava. Used a lot in Fiji and some of the other areas of the world, as well as St. John's wort, valerian root. I think those are the more commonly suggested ones. In my clinical experience, herbal remedies work with mild anxiety disorders. As you're going through that spectrum of more severe anxiety, I think they become less effective.
Yeah, I've tried those ones. They didn't really seem to have much of an effect on me.
Yeah, the only one I know of that's had some critical, really well-done science is St. John's wort for depression, and I don't think it held up. Again, your experience is what we would call an anecdotal experience. That means you had some success, or you believe you've had some success, and that's by itself not enough to suggest that it's going to be successful for a large group of people.
Right, I understand. I was just curious. I did have some help with the ayahuasca, but heard that the iboga was more effective, and was just, well, thank you very much.
Yep.
I appreciate your help.
The other side of any treatment, I have preached on here over and over again, you got to always ask yourself, what's the risk of treatment, what's the risk of not treatment, and what's the known harms? And every treatment's got some risks. So you want to investigate the risk side of things as well as not addressing the problem well also. So, you know, those are just general, you know, common sense kind of things we often forget to think about.
One other thing to this caller, I would like to recommend a workbook. It's called the Anxiety and Phobia Workbook, and I consider it the Bible when I work with clients with anxiety disorders. It not only talks about some of the diet, the exercise, the natural remedies, but also very, very specific cognitive behavioral tools that you can implement, like thought-stopping techniques, etc. And again, it's called the Anxiety and Phobia Workbook. I would highly recommend it for anyone with an anxiety disorder.
Anxiety and Phobia Workbook?
The Anxiety and Phobia Workbook.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You bet. All right, we're getting into about 15 minutes or so left. There's a couple of emails. I want to make sure we got time to talk about some treatment stuff. We kind of alluded to those. Here's an email. Can you address anxiety premenopause, menopause, and you may want to talk about menstrual. I don't remember if that was an issue you brought up before, so let's address that.
Thank you for bringing this question, because this is a specific area of concern for me, especially the premenstrual dysphoric disorder. Typically, women will experience approximately 1 week prior to their menses an increase in irritability, an increase in anxiety, and an increase in just feeling edgy, kind of almost going over the edge. And we know this is related to the hormonal fluctuations, and we know for many years that the treatment really is the serotonin agents if we're looking pharmacologically. Prozac was the first one used. It's now come out as Sarafem. Don't fall for that. Sarafem is just glorified 20 milligrams of Prozac. Typically in my practice, if I have someone experiencing a mood disorder and I have them on a serotonin agent like Prozac or Lexapro, I'll increase it by 50% for the 1 week prior to menses. So if someone's on 20 milligrams of Prozac, I'll increase it to 30 milligrams, and it seems to give great reduction in symptoms. A lot of OBGYNs will use one of the serotonin agents independent of a mood disorder just for those 7 days prior to menses, and it seems to have a great effect. Everything I've just said translates perfectly to perimenopause and postmenopausal women as well because of those hormonal fluctuations. The treatment of choice really is pharmacologically a serotonin agent.
I have an email. It says, where can I find mental health services in Anchorage that offer a sliding scale payment plan?
Anchorage Community Mental Health is the place to start.
Okay.
And also, Anchorage Health Services, or the health center, will deal with some psychiatric issues as well.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about treatment. We've alluded to the known effective treatments, let's just start with them. We know cognitive behavioral therapy. We know that medications work. So let's stick with those. We have very good science to suggest those. Is one better than the other? Do they complement each other? How do you address, how do you use those kind of things?
Absolutely complement one another. Now, I think bottom line, therapy works better than medications. However, if someone is so highly anxious that they're not able to sit through a therapy session.
Think. They can't think.
Exactly, or concentrate. Right. They're not in a state of mind where they're able to use the therapeutic tools that they're being taught. And I've had many therapists in this town send me a number of clients who just weren't able to engage in the therapy necessary. Mm-hmm. So we initially will use medications to tone down the nervous system to help the person feel in more control, and then they're better able to utilize the tools in therapy.
Mm-hmm.
First-line medical treatment involves the serotonin reuptake inhibitors, the things like Prozac, Celexa, Lexapro. Some of the newer
They're often called antidepressants, but don't get fooled by that label.
Correct.
Is that true?
They are very calming antidepressants, and they work just as well on anxiety, especially the newer ones seem to work as well on anxiety as they do on depression.
Okay.
Now, with panic disorder, if you're having a panic attack once every 2 months, probably not going to want to be on an antidepressant that you have to take every day that has side effects. So we may use quick in, quick out, immediate release Xanax. A lot of the benzodiazepines are second line treatment for severe anxiety. They have a bad rap dating back to the 60s, the whole Mother's Little Helper, Valium thing from the Rolling Stones. What we do know is that we do not use Valium in psychiatry. It makes people more depressed. But there are anti-anxiety agents, depending on the disorder, that are appropriate for the treatment.
Okay.
Probably the number one medication prescribed today for generalized anxiety disorder is Klonopin, and it's very effective. Steady blood level.
So again, what I'm always hearing is you got to individualize the particular patient and their situation. And I'm going to go ahead and say that my understanding also is that cognitive behavioral therapy or maybe some other talk therapies in general have a better long-term outcome because they're teaching you how to deal with these things. The medications never address that. Is that
Absolutely.
A good selling point?
Absolutely.
But it's not that the medications may not be appropriate at certain times.
I think that medications many times are appropriate. Again, in PTSD, we're talking a long-standing condition, and people are experiencing lots of hyperarousal symptoms. We need to calm those symptoms down, and then they're able to engage in other therapies like, and I'm going to turn over to Prentice here in a moment, EMDR, which I think is revolutionized the treatment of PTSD.
Right. So, Prentice, you can't write prescriptions like Anne Marie and I. So what's your perspective?
I can. I don't have the goodie bag. No treats for the kids. I think it's, you know, for me, I have a lot of clients who just don't really want medications.
Yep.
And they come in, they're
sure.
like, I don't want to take anything.
Yep.
And so I say, okay, well, let's try these things. And we'll come up with a plan that addresses the thinking problems and the behavioral problems that are sort of feeding each other and making each other stronger. I mean, if we continue to act and make choices that create bad things in our lives and defeat ourselves, then we'll continue to have anxiety. So it really is about changing those behavior patterns. But as Anne-Marie said, there are people who, you know, it's like trying to find your way out of a room and it's pitch black. You know, and the medication can shed a little bit of light on it so you can sort of see a path is kind of how I describe medications to people.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll try some things first, and if not, then, you know, not afraid of it. Yeah. Absolutely not. Yeah. It can be very helpful.
All right. I want to come back to some other ideas with the therapies besides medications, but we have a caller, and I want to address that, and then we'll come back. Hannah, you're on line one.
Hi. I just wanted to ask a question. You have spoken about the physical results of anxiety and panic disorders, but what about underlying physical conditions such as chronic illnesses that lead to anxiety?
Yep.
Can those still be addressed with therapy, even if the underlying disorder or disease can't be addressed?
Yep. So what you're saying is if I – and you, my little note on my computer here says you're talking about perhaps celiac disease. So asthma, celiac disease, other heart disease, cancer, all of these have a possibility of leading to anxiety and depression. And you're asking, is it okay and can we go ahead and treat those anxieties and it related to those chronic diseases? Is that right?
Right, even if you can't,
it's
underlying condition.
Yeah, uncurable underlying diseases, which many things are. I want to keep pointing out, we're advancing in great strides, but we're not curing a hell of a lot yet.
I mean, isn't being alive uncurable?
Chronic disease. Parenting is a chronic disease. I use that in my office all the time.
I think for me, in my practice, one of the things that I want to check on immediately is a person's thyroid level. If they have hyperthyroidism or an overactive thyroid, they are going to be feeling anxiety symptoms. There's also some relationship of some studies that show panic disorder related to mitral valve prolapse. So there are some medical conditions, absolutely. Hypothyroidism is definitely associated with depression. So if you're a patient of mine, I need to know that your thyroid is working perfectly before we institute any type of treatments.
Yeah, the first thing is...
Hannah's saying, all right, I got a chronic disease.
Right, okay.
Do I go ahead and can I address the anxiety? Am I right, Hannah?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, that's what... All right, I want to make sure
will
we get her...
Will it go away even if the underlining cause of the anxiety is still there?
I gotcha.
Okay, good question. I understand that.
Okay. Here's my short answer for that, is that chronic illness, if you be it diabetes, lupus, Raynaud's,
good.
I mean, pick
good.
One,
yep.
Is a condition that people live with. And if they're going to live with it, it creates a significant amount of anxiety. Pain creates anxiety, as we talked about, and a lot of these things mm-hmm. like fibromyalgia have chronic pain associated with them. But there's a treatment called acceptance and commitment therapy, ACT. A lot of these are different. Dialectical behavioral therapy. Some of these help specifically with the chronic illness piece of it and helping you learn to accept and live with that as part of who you are and just embracing that.
Yeah, and that's a lot to what is happening with palliative care, I think, at the end of life care, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The same kind
yes.
of ideas. You know, I can't sing, so it's not a big effect on me, but if I had to go to school every day and sing in front of people, I'd tell a lot of my kids who have different issues that they're bullied about or whatever. So none of us have the full Monty, so to speak. I guess I don't know if that's part of the therapy that you guys use. Or
you know, for people with chronic pain, which is, the full Monty thing is not something I have used. No. It just took me a second to realize
goodness.
What was happening. Yeah, I'm not sure I'm okay with
it. I meant that a little differently than I think we interpreted it. But yeah. So yeah, Hannah, the answer is sure, you can, should be addressed, should try to be addressed. And in fact, I would argue that controlling or trying to address the anxiety may help the underlying disease, even though it might be incurable.
And I see that frequently in my multiple sclerosis patients. I consult with the local neurologist. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And again, it's the acceptance of where they're at. It's being able to live each day to the fullest when they're in remission. And if they're having an exacerbation, how to be able to manage that. And the anticipatory anxiety in between remissions about having an exacerbation, absolutely responsive to therapy.
Great example. I worked with a guy who was in the active dying process, but and it was anywhere from 6 months to 5 years, depending on how well he took care of himself. And so it was a terminal disease and chronic and difficult to breathe and things like that. But he made the biggest shift once he just accepted that it is what it is, and he's going to live every day to its fullest instead of sitting around feeling sorry for himself and, as he said, waiting for death to come. Which.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Good luck. All right, mindfulness and EMDR. I got down here as treatment. We got just a couple minutes. You grab one of them and tell me about it.
EMDR is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. It's similar to the eye movement mimics like REM sleep, which is when they think a lot of the experiences throughout the day are integrated into our memory banks. And so EMDR sort of recalls those memories and brings them back from their storage place and reprocesses them so that they take some of the emotional weight off of them. And they're not like, if you're traumatized as a child at 6 years old, that experience, you're having panic attacks as an adult, that experience is remembered as a six-year-old to remember it, not as an adult. And so that's what EMDR does, is it brings that memory back and then reprocesses it. So the mindfulness concept is something that's very consistent with in cognitive behavioral, dialectical behavioral therapy, and an acceptance and commitment is just this concept of dealing with whatever is in front of us, doing the best that we can in any given moment, and taking care of the business in front of us will lead to good things in our life, lead to us feeling better about ourselves, and that whole mind, body, spirit sort of thing.
One of the things I'd like to add with EMDR, it is a biological therapy. It does actually change the brain pathways to healthier pathways. And in fact, it is endorsed highly by the Department of Defense for use with returning veterans who may have experienced trauma.
All right, we're in our last 45 seconds. This is where I give you guys a chance to sum up what you want everybody to not forget from today's presentation.
That was quick. I would say that the biggest thing for me is that if you think that you might have an anxiety disorder, it's important to go and talk to somebody about it, because these things are not any, they don't resolve by themselves, and they are treatable. 60 to 90% is the numbers. That's a big range, but the range for the people who don't get help is somewhere between 0 and 2%, I think. So talk to somebody about it and find out if it's a disorder or if it's just normal adjustment stuff.
Thank you for your time. Appreciate the opportunity to be able to educate some folks.
Good. Get some help and do it early.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thanks to both of you, Anne-Marie Zach, Prentice Pemberton. It's been a quick and very enjoyable time for me. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Next week, we're going to be back, and what we're going to be talking about is helping parents cope when they have an ill and often premature and tiny infant. Our guest will be Stephanie Musselman. She is a medical social worker at the Prov Neonatal Intensive Care. So why not tune into your health and learn more next Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. And remember, we repeat each evening at 7 p.m. on 91.1 KSKA. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and helped us with our phone calls today. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.